Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta, the amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading for you today in digest format, CQ Magazine, for August 2010. CQ is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website, a very fine website, updated daily, www.handyham.org. Let's begin today with ham radio news. Busy hurricane season predicted. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center says it anticipates a busy Atlantic hurricane season this year. The Atlantic hurricane season began on June 1st. The center says it is likely that there will be 14 to 23 named storms, of which 8 to 14 may develop into hurricanes with sustained winds above 73 miles per hour, and 3 to 7 may become major hurricanes of Category 3 or higher out of 5 categories being highest. NOAA is the parent agency of both the National Weather Service and the National Hurricane Center. Ham radio operators will again activate station WX4NHC at the National Hurricane Center this year, beginning the fourth decade of a formal relationship with amateur radio and the National Hurricane Center. Hams in areas threatened or affected by tropical storms or hurricanes are encouraged to gather and relay information to the center through WX4NHC. The Hurricane WatchNet on 14.325 MHz is activated whenever a tropical storm or hurricane in the Atlantic Basin threatens to hit land. WX4NHC may also be contacted via Echolink and IRLP using Echolink's WX-Talk Conference Room, that's node 7203, or IRLP node 9219. WX4NHC and its contributions are being featured on the National Hurricane Center's Hurricane Preparedness Observations web page. W3BE, that's Whiskey 3 Bravo Echo, proposes bringing back disaster radio service. John Johnston, W3BE, who spent years administering the amateur radio service at the FCC before retiring, has proposed creating a new disaster radio service made up entirely of licensed amateurs to operate during disasters and thrills without regard to whether an operator is paid or employed by the agency on whose benefit he or she is operating. The notice of proposed rulemaking suggests that the DRC follow the MARS, Military Auxiliary Radio System, model of using hams as its operators and frequencies shared with or near current ham allocations. Since all operators would hold ham licenses, licensing in the proposed DRC would be by rule, and no separate licenses or call signs would be issued. At press time, the Federal Communications Commission has not responded to the petition of John Johnston, W3BE. No signals from satellite heard for Venus. Anissa Joy of a strong signal reports from a ham satellite on a journey to Venus have been tempered by the satellite silence after the first day of transmissions. The Unitech 1 satellite was built in Japan and was designed to help hams and universities develop their capabilities to receive interplanetary signals, according to the AMSAT News Service. The first round of signals on May 21 were the only ones received, however, and at press time a month later, the satellite remained silent. Updates, if any, are available on the Unitech One website. South African hymns on standby during the World Cup games. The South African Radio League's HamNet Emergency Communications Organization was on standby to provide backup communications across the country during the World Cup soccer football tournament held there in June and July. Every city and every province had its own arrangements, according to a HamNet bulletin, which reminded hams that you are not expected to man any station anywhere. Your role is merely to be on standby should we need you at a specific point. Should a call come out, we will place people who live closest to the point where you are required to possibly pass information to the Joint Communications Center. Hence, 2 meters will be the preferred mode of transmission. FCC proposes massive overhaul of Part 95. The Federal Communication Commission in early June released a 92-page notice of proposed rulemaking aimed at streamlining and reorganizing the rules for the personal radio services covered under Part 95 of the Commission's rules. These services include CB, GMRS, that's a General Mobile Radio Service, FRS, Family Radio Service, MURS, Multi-Use Radio Service, and others. Highlights of the proposal include a recommendation to eliminate individual station licenses for GMRS, allow transmission of GPS location information on GMRS channels, and ban the inclusion of FRS capability on radios intended for use in public safety services. The notice of proposed rulemaking also asks for comments on whether the widely ignored distance restriction on CB contacts is still necessary, and whether the rules should specifically permit the use of hands-free microphones for CB transceivers. The complete MPRM may be found on the FCC's website. It is WT Docket 10-119. FCC goes after ham bootlegger over powered CBers. The FCC Special Counsel Laura Smith continues to chase down alleged rule breakers in both the amateur and CB services. In one rather bizarre case, she charges that a Matthew J. Lapham is illegally operating on the ham bands as KC5RLU, which is licensed to Matthew A. Lapham of Baker, Louisiana, the first having the initial J in the middle and the second the initial A in the middle. The real KC5RLU, Smith says, is currently serving in the United States Air Force in Iraq. No word on whether the two Matthew Laphams are related. Also in early May, Smith cited 7 CBers for allegedly using excessive power and, as a result, causing interference either to neighbors' home electronics or CBers or, in one case, the 10 and 12-meter ham bands. While these letters are made public, response from the individuals cited generally are not. China's president watches ham satellite contact. Chinese President Hu Jintao visited the amateur radio station at the China Science and Technology Museum in Beijing on May 31 and, according to the AMSAT News Service, watched and listened as several children made contacts via the Chinese-built HO-68 amateur satellite. ANS quotes Michael Chen called BD5RV Slant 1, one of 5 hams accompanying the president, as saying that President Hu encouraged the children for further activities and confirmed the positive effects of amateur satellites. It's time now for a CQ editorial, Zero Bias, by Rick Mawson, W2VU, the editor of CQ Magazine. Rick titles this one, still, quoting, successfully dying, close quote, after all these years. The drumbeat of misinformation continues unabated among many of our fellow hams. Ham radio is dying. Our numbers are dropping, often including hams who convey this information to the news media, which unknowingly reinforced a perception among the general public that ham radio is on its way out. Fact, as of May 31, 2010, there were 691,982 active licenses in the FCC amateur radio database. After adjusting for a change in the way the FCC kept track of its statistics back in 1997, this represents the all-time high number of amateur radio licenses. Fact number two, as of June 18, 2010, nearly 17,000 new people had joined the ranks of amateur radio licenses so far this year. This is 3,000 people more than the same period last year, a record-setting year for new hams, and 600 people more than became hams in the entire year of 2005. But are they active? A few weeks ago at HamCom in Texas, a ham asked me where I thought the hobby was heading. I said I believe the future looks bright and that we are at or near our all-time high in the number of licensees. I didn't have the above stats handy at the time. But how many of them are active? He responded. That's the $64,000 question, I said, adding. And that answer depends on how you define active. Well, I judge by the number of lookups a person has on QRZED, he replied. The more lookups they have, the more active they are. His method is valid, to a point. A high number of lookups on QRZ.com probably does indicate a high level of on-air activity, but more specifically, it generally indicates a high level of HF, high-frequency activity, for which QSL cards are most commonly exchanged. On the other hand, the ham who is very involved in his local radio club, participates regularly in public service and emergency communications, and maybe helps keep the club repeater on the air, but isn't on HF very much, may not meet the QRZ standard for being considered active. Neither would the ham, whose main activities involves talking with longtime friends in different parts of the world who don't need his QSL card and wouldn't need to look him up on QRZ, even if he talked on the air with them every day or every week. Neither would the ham, whose primary interests lie in experimenting, designing, and building new things, and whose on-air activity may be limited to testing out a new piece of gear or some new software. This amateur may be actively advancing the radio art, but might not be considered active based on his number of QRZ lookups. The FCC used to have an activity standard for renewing your license. Back in the day, you needed to show you had been on the air for a minimum amount of time in order to qualify for renewal. It was an arbitrary standard, to be sure, but a standard nonetheless. This requirement went away in the late 1970s, though, and since then, the definition of an active ham has been subject to wide interpretation. The fact is that activity levels are difficult to quantify or to qualify, which is why we have to rely on licensing statistics to assess the health of the hobby. So let's look at some licensing statistics, crunching the numbers. There is widespread agreement that the so-called golden age of ham radio was in the 1950s and 1960s, when American-made equipment dominated the market for commercially built gear, and when solid-state technology had not yet made enough inroads to displace tube gear and discrete components, making it still quite feasible for individual hams to build and repair their own radios. No fancy microprocessors, no microscopic surface mount components, real components and real tubes for real radios built by real hams. In 1960, according to ARRL statistics, that's the American Radio Relay League, there were 227,500 real hams in the United States. Let us assume, since this was the Golden Age, that every one of those 227,500 hams was active on the air on a regular basis, easily meeting the FCC activity requirement. Now let's look at 2010, as ham radio suffers through its supposed death throes. Let's say that only one-third of our current roughly 700,000 licensees are actually active on the air on a regular basis. Let's see. That's 700,000 times 0.333. And that comes out to 233,100, or over 5,000 more active hams today than the total number of licensed hams in 1960. If we make the numbers a little more realistic and assume that only 75% of 1960s hams were active, and that 50% of today's hams are active, by whatever definition you choose, that would give us approximately 346,000 active hams now versus 170,625 in 1960. Are roughly double the number of active hams today than in the so-called Golden Age. It is oh so clear that ham radio is dying. Another fact is that old-timers have been predicting the imminent death of ham radio ever since it came back from the dead at the end of World War II. It's never been quite the same as it was in the past, and the operators just aren't like they were in the good old days. Ham radio was going to be killed off by, successively, the novice and technician licenses, CB, computers, cell phones, the internet, and social networking. Ah, yes. Each of these supposed threats has, in fact, contributed to its vitality. I will repeat once again, for the benefit of the 100,000-plus new people who have joined our ranks in the past 4 years and haven't heard my favorite slogan before, ham radio, successfully dying for more than 60 years. So let's have a change of pace here on Zero Bias, a great idea. Oh, and as far as all those kids who are no longer getting interested in ham radio, AMCOM featured a day-long radio merit badge program for scouts from throughout the Dallas area. More than 130 boys attended, and virtually all earned their merit badges and got an introduction to ham radio through not only their lessons and demonstrations, but also through their free admission to the HamFest. Plus, the HamFest committee agreed to pay the exam fee for any scout who studied ahead of time and came to the show with proof of having scored at least 80% at least 3 times on online practice tests. 4 young men brought in the required paperwork, and all 4 went home at the end of the day as newly licensed amateurs. Congratulations to them and to the HamCom committee for such a wonderful idea. May you be widely copied to help make sure that ham radio continues successfully dying for at least another 60 years. Signed, 73, W2VU, Rich Mawson. Well, folks, those of you who listen to the CQ Magazine Digest format recordings here on the Courage Hanham system, there are announcements right near the beginning of the publication for this month, as usual, and it follows Zero Bias. So let's see what they are. The following special event stations are scheduled for August. W1H Whiskey One Hotel, in commemoration of Hiram Percy Maxim, called W1AW, who married the daughter of the governor of the state of Maryland and is buried in Hagerstown, Maryland's Rose Hill Cemetery. Antietam Radio Association, a call there, W3CWC, on August 14 and 15. Special call K5R, Kilo 5 Romeo, 5th Annual Special Event Station to commemorate the anniversaries of Hurricane Katrina and Rita, Hammond, Louisiana. The Southeast Louisiana Amateur Radio Club, SCLARC, that's going to be August 28 and 29, from 1400 to 2000 UTC each day. Call K8FBN Kilo 8 Foxtrot Bravo November from the 29th Annual Sweet Corn Festival Fairborn, Ohio on August 21 and 22. Call W8AL Whiskey 8 Alpha Lima from the Pro Football Hall of Fame Festival Canton, Ohio, sponsored by the Canton Amateur Radio Club, on August 5 through 8. The following hamfests are slated for August. August 21 and 22, Huntsville Hamfest and ARRL Southeastern Division Convention at the Von Braun Center, Huntsville, Alabama. On August 22nd, Denver Radio Club Hamfest, Jefferson County Fairgrounds, Golden, Colorado. Also on the 22nd of August, the 2010 East Central Illinois Hamfest, Vermilion County Fairgrounds, Danville, Ohio. August 28, Owen-Monroe Amateur Radio Hamfest, Owen County Fairgrounds, Spencer, Indiana. That's sponsored by the Owen County Amateur Radio Association and the Bloomington ARC. On August 28-29, Boxborough ARRL New England Convention. It's held as usual at the Holiday Inn in Boxborough, Massachusetts. And run more on August 28 and 29, the Kansas QSO Party. CQKSQP information can be found at their website. The featured article in the August 2010 CQ publication, CQ Magazine, is titled From Zone 2 Canada. This is Victor Echo 2 Delta X-Ray Yankee. For CQ, WWSSB, the authors are Andy Vafra and Erwin Darick. Our families, friends, and neighbors think we're crazy, and maybe we are. Who in their right mind would travel 1,000 miles from home to operate an amateur radio contest from a northern location where it's cold and there is snow and ice? Why not head south to some warm Caribbean country where you can drink piña coladas and lie on a beach? Sun, sand, and surf are great, but for our contesting team, it's the friendship, the challenge, the pileups, the spirited competition, and the warm Canadian hospitality that bring us back year after year to Zone 2 in northern Canada. The VE2DXY Zone 2 contesting team is made up of a dedicated team of experienced operators from the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania area. Our core group consists of Andy Favre, call KD3RF slant VE2DXY, Erwin Darack, KD3TB, and Bill Ballantyne, KF3FMQ. In 2009, two new operators joined the team, Ken Nicely, N3PSJ, and Sebastian Jean, VE2GTZ. Andy, Erwin, Bill, and Ken, all are members of the Frankfurt Radio Club, a club dedicated to improving contesting performance. So then the question is posed, why Zone 2? The definition of Rare DX is the contact your buddy made that you didn't. And with that thought in mind, our goal has always been to help put Zone 2 in the logs of as many fellow amateurs as possible. Although our team has activated Zone 2 seven times since 2007, our inspiration actually came from the tropics during CQ Worldwide Single Sideband 2001, when we operated from East Malaysia using Irwin's call sign 9M6TBT. At the end of the 2001 contest, there were only two areas of the world we did not work, Zone 2 and Zone 33. And our thinking was that many other amateurs must have missed getting Zone 2 into their log as well. Zone 2 is a rare zone in northeastern Canada and a highly desired multiplier in the CQ Worldwide contests, and we have been thanked on the air numerous times for activating it. Zone 2 is also a rare zone for CQ's Worked All Zones Award. The thanks we receive are extremely gratifying, but we also get something from the DX operation itself, as it gives our team the opportunity to be Rare DX, a station everyone else wants to contact. If you have never operated from a highly desired location or been on the receiving end of a pileup, you have to experience it at least once to be able to understand what we mean. Traveling to Zone 2 was an easy choice when we were looking for a contesting location. Although it is in a northern climate and does not have the trans-equatorial propagation that Caribbean powerhouse stations benefit from, it is an enjoyable destination, relatively easy to reach by car, and in a safe, politically stable country with a warm and friendly population. With some research and help from our friends in Canada, we identified a spot north of the 50th parallel, and in the year 2002, our first expedition was born. Except for taking a year off in 2003, when we operated from Antigua with the Frankfurt Radio Club at V2060X, we have returned to Zone 2 every year since, handing out contacts to other contesters worldwide for this much-needed part of the world. We carry everything with us on a trip to a location that takes nearly 20 hours behind a wheel to reach. It's an exhausting trip, but not without its rewards, as we travel through some of the most rugged and beautiful country in the northeastern United States and Canada to reach our destination. Each year's trip is different and has its own unique challenges, however, and in the pre-dawn darkness of October 23, 2009, we crawled along for more than 3 hours in near whiteout conditions during an early season snowstorm in the mountains north of Quebec City. Although the weather can be less than cooperative in late October, the scenery along the way is breathtaking and makes the effort worthwhile. We cross deep river gorges by ferry boat and travel along mountain ridges and through small rural towns and fishing villages as we make our way along the northern bank of the St. Lawrence River. We have seen whales and eagles in their natural settings and keep a sharp lookout for moose and bear that would be disastrous if we collided with one while en route. In many respects, the mini-D expedition that we do each year to activate Zone 2 for the contest has a lot in common with other, more exotic D expeditions you may have read about. We never leave North America, but travel more than 1,000 miles from home and bring everything we need for a field-day-style portable operation. Rigs, amplifiers, antennas, masks, feed line tools, and spare parts. We set up everything on site the day we arrive and take it all down again on Sunday night after the contest is over. Checklists and customs forms are prepared in advance and everything is carefully packed. Just like the larger D expeditions that travel by air to more exotic destinations and have baggage and weight limitations for what they can carry, we also have to be prudent about how much equipment we take on the trip. Everything has to fit in one vehicle, and for economy of space, ease of setup, and operating consistency between stations, we adhere to the principles of keep it simple and configure our multi-2 operation with identical radios, antennas, computers, and logging software. By following this approach, it is much easier for the operators not to have to learn a whole new setup when changing positions during the contest. Over the past 8 years, we have constantly worked at improving our results, meeting as a team months in advance to decide what we will do in terms of operating skills, transmitting and receiving equipment, antennas, and logging software in the coming year. CQ Worldwide Single Sideband 2009 was no exception. In fact, we ended up with brand new transceivers and antennas. We upgraded our rigs to LCRAF K3s in order to resolve intrastation interference problems. We got the bonus of improved sensitivity and selectivity that let us pull many more weak stations out of the noise. At the other end of the feed lines, we replaced all but one of our ground-mounted verticals, which had been suffering interference from an industrial plant across the river, with full wave loops and wire beams. Based on results we experienced in 2009, we are now convinced that full wave loop antennas are the way to go for our treeless location in Zone 2. In 2010, we will be equipping the station with a homebrew two-element quad for 10 and 15 meters, a two-element V-beam for 20 meters, single element delta loops on 40 and 80 meters, and an inverted L antenna for 160 meters. Each year we prepare our logs with previous year's contacts, looking for areas of similarity and difference between solar activity, the number of contacts, countries, and zones we have worked. During the post-contest season, we review the comparisons and discuss ideas for improving our results in future contests. Despite somewhat weak propagation, our overall score in CQWWSSB 2009 was higher than ever achieved in previous years. When you take into account the benefits gained from the lower noise, higher efficiency loop antennas we used in 2009, improved radios, and a moderate improvement in the solar flux, it became apparent why our numbers of contacts, countries, and zones increased. Something we did differently from the VE3DXYD expedition in 2009 is an idea we would like to suggest to the amateur radio community. Publicize your event, no matter how small or modest. What started out for us as a personal website quickly turned into a full-fledged online presence that gained notice from the non-amateur community and has received comments from all over the world. More information about the VE2DXY Zone 2 CQ Worldwide Single Sideband Contest Expedition, including a daily blog of our activities, a link to YouTube video from our 2008 expedition, links to online logs, and brief bios can be found at our website. However, we didn't stop there because back in the middle part of 2009, Hewlett-Packard solicited entries for the HP in Real Life website from people who had unique stories to tell about how they were using HP computers. We submitted a story about the VE3DXY, an amateur radio, and were pleasantly surprised when HP's advertising agency got in touch with us to let us know that we were selected as one of three, and now five, stories to be presented on the HP website. We were interviewed about amateur radio and our experiences operating from Zone 2, and how HP's products were helping bring voices to quiet corners of the earth. The attention from Hewlett-Packard is a testimony that amateur radio can still generate interest and awareness in the general public when it is presented in the right ways. Showing how we connected technology, from controlling our radios via computer links, to logging, to internet packet spotting networks, was fascinating to HP and its advertising agency. Be sure to visit both websites and leave a note for us in the comments area of the VE2DXY website if you like what you see. It may be tempting for readers to think of this article as a checklist to follow for a mini-D expedition of your own, but it is nothing more than a description of our experiences and what worked for us. Preparation and planning are crucial elements of any D expedition, and contesting from a rare location can be both fun and rewarding, but can be a disaster if you are not properly prepared, especially once you go outside of your home country. Your results and experiences will definitely be different. It has taken us 8 years to get to where we are now. We learned the hard way, from how to get through homeland security and U.S. customs to functioning in a part of the world that does not speak our native language, and from fixing antennas in freezing rain during a howling nor'easter to tearing amplifiers apart during the contest to repair defective relays and failed biased circuits. Thus, learn from our experiences, and whether you have in mind a mini-D expedition, an IOTA, or a VHF rover that you want to try, start modestly and be prepared, but most of all have fun doing it. Contesting and DXing are great ways to learn new skills, improve your station, make new contacts, and work new countries and zones. You don't have to be a big gun or in a rare location to have a good time. Therefore, when the next contest comes along, turn on your radio and make a few contacts, even when poor propagation, modest stations and antennas, limited budgets, and common beliefs say otherwise. Folks, this completes the article from Zone 2 Canada. that I've just been reading, there were several very lengthy websites noted for the contest team and also for the HP folks. If you're interested in going to those websites and you can't read the material yourself, if you can get a ham friend or someone to read this part of the magazine for you just for that purpose, that's fine. It's the August 2010 issue of CQ Magazine from page 13 through page 16. The next major piece in CQ for the month of August, Organize Your Own Backyard Upgrade Class. It's authored by Gordon West, called WB6NOA, Whiskey Bravo 6, November Oscar Alpha. The path for technician class operators to upgrade to general class has been easier since the FCC eliminated the Morse code exam for all licensed classes. However, upgrading still takes a lot of study, and to form a class with trained mentors can be very helpful. Renting a classroom for CAM radio training can be expensive, though, and neighborhood community centers likely will ask for expensive insurance policies as well. Rented facilities may also have little to no outside access for live antenna demos. Therefore, how do you make an upgrade class affordable, educational, and fun? The answer? Take it outside during warm weather months in a cooperating club member's backyard. With required homesteading and workbook completion before class, a weekend technician to general upgrade class will be very popular. And live equipment and outside HF dipole and vertical antennas demos, and expect a big crowd. Our local American Red Cross volunteer communications team made up the student body for our first outdoor upgrade course. We had volunteer instructors and donated facilities. The class was free except for the cost of textbooks. A date was set in springtime in the big backyard of Kevin, KG6MIH, Bobby, KG6MIF, and Cliff, KG6MIG. Last name of Guice, G-U-I-C-E, was commissioned for the classroom. A patio cover provided shade, and there was wheelchair access for our communicators with special needs. Kevin, KG6MIH, with his own wheelchair, is also an extra-class volunteer examiner whose credentials allow him to take part in testing on Sunday afternoon, where the students come to him. Our class photographer was Pandora Nash-Kerner, KE6ZVD, who came in from several hundred miles away to both digitally document the class and take her own general class upgrade training and exam. Well ahead of time, Susie and 6GLF prepared all students with their general class theory pre-study assignments. Workbooks had been provided in which students answered additional questions based on their book study before the weekend class. The backyard class at Kevin's house focused on live equipment, operating procedures, antennas, and antenna safety, and two fun-filled days of learning and playing radio. We started at the front of the book with rules and regulations and ended up the next day with RF safety, related book questions to the real world of using radios and antennas. Here are some of our backyard ham upgrade experiments. Dipoles versus tripod verticals. Demos of various HF radios on different antennas. Evaluating standing wave ratio with MFJ analyzers. Making live contacts and operating courtesy. All about antenna safety around radio frequency emissions. Built-in versus external automatic tuners. Manual tuners and tune-up procedures. Hearing DSP, that's digital signal processing at various levels. Solar panels and batteries. Making your first contact. There were plenty of highlights during the two-day backyard class. Kevin assisted with talk-in on Saturday morning, and the neighborhood quickly filled up with vehicles. Neighbors were alerted ahead of time, and their kids were invited to take part in the ham radio excitement. Digital communications were demonstrated by Tom, W6WC, and Bill, K6ACJ. This gave the students an exciting computer view of radio whistles, that's PSK, that can be turned into live text. The mobile units displayed the myth that new general class operators would need to take a drill to their vehicles to install a mobile HF antenna. A new student saw the many advantages of lip mounts and magnetic mount high-frequency antenna systems. No holes needed to be bored for these. Co-host Cliff, KG6MIG, an avid electronics buff, had plenty of solar panels and gel cell batteries to demonstrate throughout the weekend. Cliff and Kevin provided the students with some terrific high-frequency contacts from their roof-mounted 5-band vertical antenna affixed to an iron plumbing pipe on the back side of the roof. We continuously underscored the importance of RF safety around antennas, as well as personal safety, when working with any roof-mounted antenna and dangerous power line 75 feet away. Our mobile antenna demos required all students to wear protective glasses. On Sunday, our first contact was on 20 meters with a station on the East Coast. We described our class, our equipment, our antenna ground, that's the wrought iron fence surrounding the swimming pool, and our antenna system, a 7 feet of old sprinkler pipe insulated from ground. This crazy lash-up allowed us to demonstrate a manual tuner and to illustrate that nearly anything can be turned into an effective antenna system, maybe only 2 dB down from the professional roof-mounted 5-band vertical. Everyone laughed. Sunday afternoon was test time, and those who had completed their home study before class hardly missed any questions on the elementary general class exam. Those who completed only a portion of the home study tended to miss 5 or 6 questions, and the few who had little chance to work on the pre-study general opted to take another class at a later date. The home study makes teaching the class and testing a breeze. The weather cooperated, all demos were successful, and the backyard venue allowed many more live antenna tests than I could have pulled off inside a classroom. We recommend keeping the class size to about 30. This makes managing the facilities and related accommodations, including munchies, easier. Classes smaller than 30 will drain the helmer or the instructor. While I have taught classes of 10 and 15, the enthusiasm and excitement of a larger class is contagious. However, too large a class can be unwieldy, and we found 30 to be just right, although your mileage may vary. Speaking of munchies, thanks to Tom, KI6GOA, with the American Red Cross Orange County chapter, flipping burgers was just a part of his upgrade requirement. Finally, after the students arrive and before any antenna demos, check for safety. Make sure no one will trip over your portable PA system speaker wires, that all mobile antennas have rubber ball tips, and that any multi-band verticals on the lawn for display have sharp elements covered with lightweight rubber play balls. Coax cable on the lawn must have no trip hazards. Think safety. Will we do more classes in the backyard? Absolutely. It sure beats talking about antennas when you can actually string up antennas and see how they play with live radio checks. As we move forward here on the August 2010 reading of CQ magazine, the results for the 2009 CQ Worldwide DX Single Sideband Contest are being presented beginning on page 22. There's a tremendous amount of information here. CQ magazine, of course, sponsors many of these contests, and hence it feels responsible for giving you the results if you participated in them in any way. So for any of you who are involved, have been involved, and want to know what some of the results are, the information appears on page 22 and forward of the August 2010 issue of CQ Magazine. I guess our reading wouldn't be complete if we didn't go to Washington Readout. The author here is Frederick O. Maya, called W5YI. It said, "Where Things Stand, a roundup of pending amateur radio rulemaking." The Federal Communications Commission makes a presentation every year at the Dayton Hamvention, during which one or more representatives discuss the status of amateur radio regulatory affairs. The primary speaker this year was Sir William Cross, called W3TN, an official in the mobile division of the FCC's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau. This is the FCC office responsible for overseeing the amateur radio service. The Wireless Bureau regulates all U.S. domestic non-government radio-based telecommunications. Bill started by saying that the FCC, quoting here, has an unusually large number of amateur radio proposed rule changes out for comment, adding that there are a couple of other matters open also. What I'm going to do is talk about a number of rulemaking proceedings that we have opened in the past year, a couple of public notices that have come out, and the Commission's National Broadband Plan, or NBP, as it's affectionately known, and how it may affect your service. Changes to the 60-meter band. The first item Cross discussed was the recently released Notice of Proposed Rulemaking in ET Docket Number 10-98. This NPRM was issued in response to a 2006 petition for rulemaking filed by the American Radio Relay League. This proceeding concerns the five channels that make up the 60-meter ham band. Since May 2003, the FCC has allowed ham secondary access to five discrete 2.8 kHz wide channels on a non-interference basis to primary federal government users. The allocation was made after the FCC agreed that 5 MHz frequencies could be useful for disaster communications when 80, 75, and 40 meters are not available due to ionospheric conditions. Amateurs may use only upper sideband with a maximum effective radiated power of 50 watts on 60 meters. One of the aforementioned channels, 5368 kHz, is seldom available because of occupancy by the primary user. The proposal is to substitute another channel at 5358.5 kHz. The NPRM also looks toward increasing the allowed ERP, effective radiated power, from 50 to 100 watts and permitting certain digital modes. CW, PSK31, and PAC-TOR 3 emissions would be allowed with conditions to ensure that those operations are compatible with other users of the channel. Those conditions could include using voice-operated transmit VOX, VOX, while in the single sideband emission mode, and limiting the duration of data transmissions. In the United States, regulatory responsibility for the radio spectrum is divided between the FCC, which administers spectrum for non-federal use, and the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, which regulates government frequencies. The request for these 60-meter band changes was coordinated with and has been approved by NTIA. The idea here is to make the 60-meter band more useful to you all, Cross explained, while making sure the primary users can also use the channels. Now, for the listener, this article goes on at length. It talks about power limit on the spread spectrum, housekeeping changes, vanity and club call signs, emergency communications, prohibiting communications, American Hospital Association waiver requests, National Broadband Plan, RAISES, which is the acronym for Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service, and also Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Enactment Act. You can see just the subtitles are rather lengthily presented. The material is full of information that many of you would be interested in, specifically to certain categories of commentary. And they begin on page 50 and go all the way to page 53 of August 2010 CQ Magazine. I think I'll go now to kit building. The author here is Joe Eisenberg, called K0NEB. It's titled Manhattan Style Construction. It was great to see so many of my readers at the Dayton this year. I hope to bring you more articles that kit builders want to read. I got lots of suggestions about future topics, so I know my work is cut out for me. This month I want to talk about a construction technique that is growing in popularity among builders. The technique is called Manhattan construction due to the finished product's resemblance to the big city and its densely packed high-rise buildings. Many kit builders are familiar with regular printed circuit board construction, but a lot fewer have ever seen or tried Manhattan-style construction. That is because most major kit suppliers do not make any in this style, but the number of Manhattan kits is growing. Manhattan has advantages and disadvantages. It is not as neat as a pre-made board, but is a lot lower in cost and has an advantage of providing a solid ground plane, often lacking on some PC boards. There are a lot of homebrew projects made this way as well. The basics of Manhattan construction are simply using a blank sheet of double-sided PC board cut to the size desired for the project and a number of round pieces of the same board punched and then glued to the surface of that blank board. In most Manhattan kits, a pattern template is provided to allow you to put dots on the board to locate where the Manhattan pads will be glued. By printing the template and placing it over the blank board, you can poke holes in the paper and then use a felt tip pen to mark the spots. Most often, some type of cyanacrylate glue, often called super glue, is used to attach the pads to the board. Some epoxy glues work well too. Some builders have used solder paste, as is used for the surface mount construction, and then heat the board with a low airflow heat gun, or bake it in a small toaster oven to melt the solder. Keep in mind during construction that heating glued or soldered pads too much can loosen their bond to the main board. A proven method to easily make the round pads is to use a scrap from your main board material after you cut your main board to size. There are a few metal punch tools on the market that work for this purpose. Two available from Harbor Freight include number 44060 and number 91510 hand punches for $20 to $25. The resulting round pads are used on your main board. These punches can also be used to punch nice holes in Altoid or similar tins, making for very neat cases. There's also a new source for pre-made Manhattan pads. They're offered by Rex, called W1REX at www.qrpme.com. These pads are square and come on a board that is scored, so the pads snap off in rows and can then easily be separated by carefully breaking them apart. The pads come pre-tinned and ready to go. Max calls them ME pads and ME squares. The ME pads are designed for mounting ICs and other similar components that have closely spaced pins and include pads designed for regular DIP ICs as well as surface mount ICs. Both types of Rex's pre-made Manhattan pad sheets sell for $10 apiece. These pads are also not double-sided, so they will need to be glued in place. Now, with regard to installing the parts, allow plenty of time for the glue to set before beginning to place components on the board. When placing the parts on the board and pads, you will find that trimming the length of the leads and then bending them to form a kind of right angle foot works the best. Be sure to make the legs that solder to a pad shorter than the leads that solder directly to the board to keep the parts standing upright. Also, it is a good idea to not have the components standing too tall above the board, as there can be problems with some RF circuits if too much lead is exposed. Since ground is the most common connection in most circuits, connecting to ground is the easiest thing to do in the Manhattan style. Simply solder the ground lead to the main board. The pads serve as insulation junction points for interconnecting parts. A good photograph and diagram are essential to succeed in making a Manhattan kit. Most of these kits come with a good quality photo and diagram you often download to print out, along with templates for the pad locations. Now the subtitle, New Kits at Dayton. Many more new kits were introduced at Dayton Hamvention this past May. Some of them include Hendrix kits, a new Tuthill 15, a 15-meter CW transceiver with digital dial, a new surface mount or through-hole mount dummy load kit, a 40-meter CW transceiver with a digital dial option, and a CW keyer, audio amp kit. Pacific Antennas introduced its compact 40 slant 20-meter trap dipole kit and looks easy to put together and enjoy. And the author goes on to define various other products in this article, which concludes on page 74 of the August 2010 issue. He concludes by saying, don't let the summer hemp fest season go by without looking over the latest in kits and parts and tools for the builder. I have been busy as well and will be bringing more construction reviews and tips on new kits. Remember to say hi if you see me at the Huntsville Hemp Fest without my Dayton hat or any other hemp fest. Signed, 73 D.E. Joe K0NEB. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this month's reading of CQ Magazine for August 2010 in digest format here on the Courage Handy Hemp System. CQ Magazine is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. If you wish to call them, you could telephone at area 516-681-2922. Or you can actually email, if you have capabilities. It's lowercase cq at cq-amateur-radio.com. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hemp members only. Any of the use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hemps may be reached at area 763-520-0512, or at email address, lowercase, one word, handyham, that's spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, handyham@courage.org. The website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF. My geographic location, QTH, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, near Buzzards Bay in Cape Cod. Come on down, it's still summer. We look forward to seeing you. And as you go by exit 12 in Dartmouth, wave 73s and 1BLF.